Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Impeachment, like autumn, is in the air. Leaves are falling. A dictionary definition of impeach is to question the credibility of someone or to bring an accusation against a person and to accuse a public official of misconduct by bringing charges to an appropriate tribunal, quote unquote. The sixth edition of Barron's Law Dictionary defines impeachment as analogous to an indictment in an ordinary criminal trial, except that it is a trial to remove public officials from office in order to, quote, reach high and potent offenders, such as might be presumed to escape punishment in the ordinary tribunals, either from their extraordinary influence or from the imperfect organization and power of those organizations. The venal and unscrupulous, self-besotted Donald Trump snatched the flame of populism and declared a blustery guerrilla war on the decorum and sensibility of American democracy. He aroused the worst traits and instincts of populism and larded his nightmarish dystopian savagery with a specious white supremacist perversion of populism that scapegoats the nation's problems on those who are usually the victims: blacks, immigrants, women, and now the MSM, otherwise known as the mainstream media. Once more, an essential question arises despite its unpopularity among the governing class. Do the values of democracy paralyze us to its flagrant electoral coup d'etat and virtual collapse by a repellent pariah and its criminally misfit cabal who are unfit to represent democracy? As repulsive and corrupt as Trump has shown himself to be, the basic tenets of democracy have failed from the start to contain Trump's vile presidency. So perhaps you might accept this ode or a warning, whichever you might think of it, from the ancient Greek poet Pindar, who is claimed to be the most praised and least read of his ancient generation. Even for the feeble, it is an easy time to shake a city to its foundation, but it is a sore struggle to set it in place again. And that was Pindar. Donald Trump accuses the growing numbers who are turning against him as they see, or can no longer abide, his true character as not only disloyal — loyalty is a very big thing to his megalomania, although he displays none toward anyone — but also lacking courage, a fine thing for him to say, who has never demonstrated valor of any sort, which is something very different than his own swaggering, big-mouthed bellicosity of a pseudo barroom bully unmatched by deed or action, protected all of his life by family wealth and bodyguards. This fetid affair reawakens a mind snap of a long-ago hippie poster of Richard Nixon and Spiro Agnew as unshaven countermen and cook, respectively, in a gag and barf diner somewhere in the USA. The crux of the drawing is of the snarling, bristly-chinned Nixon thrusting a plate of red, white, and blue spaghetti and star-spangled meatballs straight out of the poster and, presumably, into the viewer's face. "Shut up and eat it," Nixon demands. Donald Trump has said and acted all along, his entire privileged life, that he is above and beyond the law. As president, following a career of real estate corruption and cable television celebrity, Trump insists on executive immunity, tantamount to divine privilege of old royalty, and in particular of a king, one of whom America's Yankee Doodle ancestors revolted against in favor of democracy. Trump is comically arrogant in his disavowal of congressional equality. It is the major instrument of constitutional viability. If for no other reasons, presidents do not appreciate being in equal power with common masses, such as the unroyal house with its brass precepts of individual and collective liberty and justice for all. Of course, Trump claims that the Constitution's impeachment provisions are unconstitutional. talk about comedy. And what I would like to read next is a very good explanation of impeachment. It's by Harvard University professor, law professor, Noah Feldman, and he wrote it for the New York Times. This is the constitutional crisis. What happens next? For the first time since President Richard Nixon refused to turn over the White House tapes, the United States is facing a genuine constitutional crisis. To be sure, Donald Trump had already created a crisis in the presidency by abusing the power of his office to pressure foreign governments to investigate his political rival, Joe Biden. But that act on its own didn't count as a constitutional crisis, because the Constitution prescribes an answer to presidential abuse of office, impeachment. Now that President Trump has announced, via a letter signed by Pat Cipollone, the White House counsel, that he will not cooperate in any way with the impeachment inquiry begun in the House of Representatives, we no longer have just a crisis of the presidency. We also have a breakdown in the fundamental structure of government under the Constitution. That counts as a constitutional crisis. A constitutional crisis exists when two conditions hold. First, we face a situation where the Constitution does not provide a clear, definitive answer to a basic problem of governance. Second, the political actors whose conflict is creating the problem appear ready to press their competing course of action to the limit. With Watergate, those two conditions were met. When President Nixon refused to comply with a valid subpoena issued by a federal court, there was no clear answer in the Constitution as to which branch of government would prevail. Nixon wouldn't budge, and neither the special prosecutor nor the court was willing to back down. The crisis was resolved only after the Supreme Court ordered the tapes to be turned over and Nixon resigned. President Trump's stonewalling of the House impeachment inquiry also satisfies the two conditions for a constitutional crisis. First, the Constitution doesn't indicate what is supposed to happen if the House tries to exercise its constitutional power of oversight to investigate the president, and the president flatly rejects the House's constitutional authority. Congress can demand that the president comply, but it can't very well send its sergeant-at-arms to the White House to enforce its subpoenas. You might say that under the Constitution, the House could justifiably impeach the president for refusing to participate in the impeachment inquiry. Indeed, the third article of impeachment adopted by the House Judiciary Committee against Nixon charged him with contempt of Congress for ignoring subpoenas issued by Congress. Yet, as Trump appears to be calculating, it's not so simple or satisfying for the House to proceed to impeachment without a factual inquiry. Impeaching a president for refusing to participate in an impeachment inquiry is a kind of meta-impeachment. It would allow Trump to argue that the meta-impeachment is illegitimate because it isn't based on an investigation. That brings us to the second condition, namely that neither of the key actors seems prepared to back down. About the only thing the House could do now would be to pass a resolution formally authorizing the impeachment inquiry, something it has not yet done, and which the House counsel cited in his letter as a reason to consider the current inquiry unprecedented, quote unquote. To the contrary, passing a resolution to investigate impeachment would raise the stakes in the constitutional confrontation. President Trump, for his part, could in theory back down once the House passes such a resolution and start cooperating in the inquiry. That would avert the crisis. It is just barely conceivable that the motivation for the White House counsel's letter was to force House Democrats to go on the record individually as supporting an impeachment inquiry. The White House counsel's letter, however, strongly signals that Trump won't start cooperating even if the House passes a resolution to authorize the inquiry. The letter makes a number of independent arguments for why the current impeachment inquiry is unconstitutional and illegitimate, and those who would presumably still apply even if the House passed a resolution authorizing the inquiry. Assuming that Trump isn't backing down, we're witnessing a full-on confrontation between the House and the President with no simple resolution available. When two branches of government are locked in a standoff, it's always possible that the third branch of government might come in to resolve it. In this instance, that's judiciary, and the Supreme Court is the obvious candidate for the role. Faced with presidential refusal to comply with subpoenas, the House could seek judicial enforcement of its subpoenas. As a matter of ordinary constitutional law, there is little doubt that the House's argument before the courts would be much stronger than any offered in lawyer Cipollone's letter. It is well-settled constitutional doctrine that Congress may issue subpoenas for any valid legislative purpose. The Constitution gives the House the power to impeach. An impeachment inquiry is therefore a valid legislative purpose under the Constitution, and impeachment-related subpoenas should be enforced by the courts. The President could always assert executive privilege with respect to particular confidential documents. Such claims of privilege could be analyzed by the courts under existing constitutional precedents. There is no precedent in constitutional doctrine, however, supporting a president's blanket refusal to comply with any subpoenas regardless of privilege. More to the point, Cipollone's letter presents the president as the judge of whether a congressional inquiry into impeachment is constitutional. That obviously cannot be right. Not only would that violate the principle of separation of powers, it also would effectively put the president in ultimate control of the impeachment process. Given the extreme weakness of Trump's arguments, it's probable that the lower federal courts would side with the House. Going to the Supreme Court, however, is always a bit of a gamble. The court's four more liberal justices would undoubtedly side with the House. The court's four most conservative justices, two of them appointed by Trump, would find themselves in a quandary. Given the weakness of Trump's arguments, it is possible to imagine that they would take the position that the judicial branch should abstain from a conflict between the other two branches, a way of dodging the issue that would effectively allow them to give Trump a victory. That would leave the balance of power with Chief Justice John Roberts, who is a judicial conservative, but above all wants to protect the court from appearing partisan. The trouble is, there would be almost no way for the Supreme Court to resolve the current crisis without seeming as though it was taking a side in a political fight. What would happen? A good guess is that Chief Justice Roberts, with his back to the wall, would stand up for the clear constitutional precedent that says the courts will enforce valid congressional subpoenas. The Supreme Court chose the rule of law over President Nixon, a precedent that will not be lost on Justice Roberts. But a guess is not a constitutional reinsurance. And in a constitutional crisis, that kind of reassurance is what the Republic needs. What I have just read is "This is a Constitutional Crisis, What Happens Next?" by Noah Feldman, who is a law professor at Harvard and a columnist for Bloomberg Opinion and the host of the podcast Deep Background. He wrote this article for the New York Times. And now, Learning to Flap Wings as One by Margaret Frimuth. The bus leaves as we sing upbeat choruses to young campers. You are so beautiful. One big family, and each of us is a flower. We wave goodbye for as long as the bus is visible. Then, with the bus out of sight, some volunteers let tears flow, finding solace in the supportive arms of friends. Others breathe quietly, lost in a full range of emotions. We take time to gather our belongings and our thoughts. Then we sit down together and talk about our experiences, our emotions, our fears, and our hopes for the children who shared the last 3 days with us. Before we leave camp, we build a transitory bridge to the other side, where the world is not as safe, where community is threatened by individual desires and singular entitlements, where people are mistreated and blamed, where possessions are more protected than people, where war is on the minds of the mighty, while hunger ravages the most vulnerable. Before we leave camp, we remind each other to guard our hearts, to tend to our physical needs, and after a weekend of attending to others, to once again extend beyond our own needs and ask our loved ones about their time while we were away. Before we leave camp, we sing together. Then we each in our own way return to the business of the world outside of safe community. I think that when the bus rounds the corner and returns the kids to the outside world, adult volunteers are left with a million unanswered questions, not just about the kids' lives, but mostly about our own. The camps demand a kind of intimacy that the world rarely embraces. Our culture typically links intimacy with sexual behavior, sexual intimacy. We are a nation confused by our inability to relate to one another honestly, intimately, without sexual contact. The social justifications for sexual frolicking are vast. The forum for sexual abstinence is bound up in a biblical bantering. Neither ideology encompasses the full spectrum of who we are, our physical and emotional needs, desires, passions, beliefs, reasons. The debate polarizes rather than informs. The consequences of sexual confusion leave our children burdened with unwanted pregnancies, a constantly increasing rise in sexually transmitted diseases, disrupted relationships, seemingly uncontrollable drug and alcohol abuse, domestic violence, child abuse, sexual abuse. Why? Because sexuality is at the core of our personhood, our individual power. To abuse that core is to devalue, in fact, destroy the person. Our individual sexuality is the essence of who we are. It is how we arrived on earth, in this body. It is the manifestation of future generations. Yet we cannot talk about sex in meaningful terms with the respect that pays homage to our soul selves. Thus we are paralyzed and are sorely equipped to respond properly to the issue of childhood sexual violence. It gets clumped in with all other uncomfortably embarrassing dialogues. Without guidance to address core trauma, the cultural norm represses the human desire to heal. This stifles all else in the lives of survivors, their families, their friends, their co-workers, their lovers, their children. Trauma is normalized, healing halted, silenced, eventually denied. Thus, violence continues. Victory over child abuse, VOCA, camps, exists precisely because sexual abuse has been used against the core personhood of the child survivor. Sexual abuse is purely for the satisfaction of the abuser. Sex, used as a weapon to overpower, used against children. It is a coward's way to gain power, but effective, especially in a culture that has difficulty respecting children and discussing sex. Sexual abuse is allowed to ravage children in the hush of adult social restraints. Culturally, this is our common experience. Yet, at VOCA camp, there is a divergence from the norm. There is an intimacy without sexual contact. Issues of safety and touch are honored rather than assumed. Safety is a goal, an ongoing process rather than a measurable outcome. Touch is used only with permission, i.e., can I give you a hug? And we practice accepting no as an appropriate answer. We demonstrate appropriate respect of personal space by drawing imaginary circles around and above our bodies, graphically defining the space we can each call our own. We sing. When I say no, I mean no. At any time, someone might call out, "Whose body is this?" with clear knowledge that anyone within hearing distance will shout back the anticipated reply, "This is my body." We talk about our personal and emotional rights. We discuss tricks and excuses that people use to break safety. We talk about alternatives to violence. We work through conflict. In these ways, we give children back the power that sexual abuse stole from them. Before VOCA camp begins, after intensive training, criminal history, and reference checks, every adult is reminded that we, the adults, have automatic power over children, not because we are better, not because we deserve it, mostly because children have been taught that adults have and will use this automatic power over them. Frankly, it's easy to victimize kids. It happens daily. It's occurred for generations, for centuries. To be safe, adults must grapple with and commit to not using what society has given us as automatic power over children. Instead, we talk about sharing our power rather than using it to maintain our authority. We discuss the old, misread adage of spare the rod and spoil the child. We disregard it as another justification for violence against children. After all, the saying is a misquote. The real meaning behind the biblical parable is a reminder to the shepherd to guide the sheep, not hit the sheep. Hitting sheep could break down and devalue the wool. No shepherd worth his herd would beat his sheep, nor will adults who truly care about children. Adulthood demands responsibility. Safe community depends on adult willingness to honestly assess power differences while also committing to the use of adult power to consciously create safety. VOCA camps are less about personal healing and more about social change. We live the world we want to live, at least for 2 long weekends each year. Once you experience the magic of safe community, it's hard to understand why it isn't the norm. It benefits everyone. It brings out our best. Together we are strong, but the world outside of camp wants us divided, weakened, embittered. When we leave camp, each of us is forced to choose between returning to life as it was before camp, or to shift our course and walk against the societal tide, attempting to find a world that makes more sense. Much of the time, it's easier to go with the flow, easier to believe that my one voice hardly matters in the barrage of conflicting voices outside of camp community. Yet the inner longing for a changed world lingers, beckoning us toward a more equitable view of the world. This occurrence itself divides us, another encounter with the perpetual institutionalization of current power over structures, accosted again, at least until next year. If we could somehow live the VOCA way most of the time, interrupted occasionally by the bustling demands of production, I believe we would be a healthier culture. That's the continuous draw of the VOCA camp community. Regardless of the emotional exhaustion, the physical fatigue, the loss of 2 weekends away from work and family, it simultaneously holds the possibility of living closer to the land, supporting one another in intimate community, while also confronting the curse of childhood sexual victimization. We return year after year after year, sensing the VOCA season before it arrives, celebrating each success as it unfolds, embracing whatever challenges await us in the next year. Together we stand, diverse, united. And that was by Margaret Frimuth, Learning to Flap Wings as One. She organized VOCA camp with a handful of adults who heard the request from child survivors of sexual abuse who wanted a camp just for them, where the secret of their sexual victimization would be safe and they could heal. That was in 1988. Currently, there are 2 annual camps in Clatsop County, one for boys, another for girls. For more information, call 503-325-2761. And remember, October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. And sexually violating or anyway violating children is domestic violence. Well, today is the 30th anniversary of the October 17th, 1989 San Francisco earthquake, the deadliest since the 1906 earthquake and fire that devastated the city. The 1989 quake measured 7.1 on the Richter scale. The earthquake killed 63 people, injured more than 3,000, and damaged more than 100,000 buildings. Millions of people who watched the Third World Series game between Oakland A's and the San Francisco Giants on television were treated to panic and pandemonium as sportscasters and cameras went into crisis mode, more like war or disaster reporters, when the earthquake shaked, rattled, and rolled the baseball stadium. This is Michael McCusker. Happy birthday on October 21st to Jesse Duncan, the year 2000 millennial star of Shanghai in Astoria as Miss Virginia Sweet. And happy platinum to my brother Bill the next day, October 22nd. I noticed that yesterday was the actress Angela Lansbury's birthday. Three movies she appeared in seemed pertinent to the moment, though each was made quite a while ago. The Picture of Dorian Gray from Oscar Wilde, whose birthday was also yesterday, born in 1854. Gaslight, a very popular word these Trump days, and The Manchurian Candidate, which explains itself.